For those who don't know me, my name's Daniel, and yeah, lovely to have you with us. We're going to start this week pretty much exactly where we finished last week, so Song of Solomon, chapter 8. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal on your arm, for strong as death is love. Fierce as Sheol is jealousy. Its sparks are fiery sparks, a fearsome flame. Many waters cannot put out love, nor waters sweep it away. As strong as death is love. That's the message of last week. It's the message of, thank you, Adam, this week as well, supporting me with some tech challenges. And last week, as Maxine sort of beautifully reminded us, we stood together at the cross with John. We saw that to the face of it, to the world, it looked like the end. That Jesus had been defeated. On the face of it, it looked like death had won. But the real question behind last week was that John said, no. He said that this was glory. And as Jesus died on the cross, just to remind you, he took on the curse of sin. He absorbed its power in himself and he unmasked the powers behind it. And we finished last week's talk with Jesus calling out, it is finished. And Jesus then himself enters death. But it's not just that his life's finished. Something much deeper is taking place. And here's the question we're going to be looking at this particular week. If that was the end last week, then what started? Because clearly, it is finished. History didn't close and the story wrap up there and then. Something finished, but then something else started. Something new began. There was an ending, but there was then another beginning. You might remember last week I mentioned how incredibly intimate of a story the Gospel of John is, how personal of a memory it is and everything he shares with us in that Gospel is. And this week we're in chapter 20. We've been reading it through the week. And something really interesting happens. The only time in John we see through someone else's eyes. We see through Mary Magdalene's eyes. Or Maria, as her name would have been said by those who knew her. Her memories become the lens through which we experience what is the most important moment in the Bible. And in the ancient world, that's pretty much unheard of. Just as an aside, a woman's story told from her perspective with emotional depth and detail that just doesn't happen in first century ancient writing. But we get that in John. We get that from John. And the personal texture of the scene, the weeping, the dialogue, that moment of recognition, it's so poignant and carefully told, it feels like memory. It reads, to me at least, as if John has heard Mary tell that story time after time. And he simply wrote it exactly as she liked to tell it. And there's a tradition in the early church that Mary Magdalene and John lived in Ephesus in their later years. And I think hearing her voice come through so clearly in the Gospel of John, I believe it. Because it's not hard to imagine the two of them, both now old, sharing stories with each other and remembering together. I can't help but wonder how much of John's memoir of Jesus' life includes Mary's touches in places we don't know. Her little flourishes, her way of telling the different stories of Jesus' life and his miracles. And that's because Mary, like John, has been with him from the very, very beginning of Jesus' ministry. Jesus had set her free from the power of some evil spirits that she was enslaved to. And from that moment on, she followed him. And like John, she was there at the end with a few other women. They stood at the cross and they watched it all unfold. We spent time last week in that place. This week's story is what happens next. So, after Jesus died, two men, Joseph from Arimathea and Nicodemus, they come and they take the body of Jesus down from the cross. They carry it to a nearby tomb and they embalmed his body with myrrh and aloes. Mary and the women followed at a distance, watching closely so they would know exactly where Jesus was laid. It wasn't far. Oh, don't worry about that. Perhaps less than 100 metres. Golgotha, just to remind you, we said was a disused limestone quarry, and the tombs were cut into the old quarry wall. And the tomb they laid Jesus in was a brand new tomb. It was unused, small garden, perhaps, with olive trees and grapevines around it. The garden might have been maybe the size of this hall, maybe smaller than that, just to give you an idea. And then when the two men finished embalming and laying the body of Jesus in the tomb, they rolled a big 1 to 2 ton stone disc made of limestone in front of the entrance. The entrance would have come to about this high. And from this place, the cross would probably still loom behind on the horizon, visible from the entrance. After that, Mary and the others, the women, return to the house they're staying in. Likely the same place Peter, John, maybe some other of the disciples are staying in as well. And it's almost overnight become a kind of safe house. Because the danger for them after the crucifixion of Jesus is still very real. That night, we learn from John, they begin to prepare spices. They begin to prepare some perfumes so that they can anoint Jesus' body. It'll be a very strong smell in the house. But they don't have long because Sabbath is coming and they'll have to stop. And I imagine when it does, they're struggling to sleep. Sometimes we can forget these kind of characters are human. But they'd be worn out from an exhausting few days. They'd be feeling restless. I imagine that images of what they've had to go through and see would be flashing through their minds as they try to close their eyes. They're huddled together in a cramped space, smelling of herbs and spices, whispering in the dark, some of them probably crying, others comforting them. And then comes Sunday. Before the first light of dawn, so very early, Mary and the other women wake up and they slip through the silent streets. The air's still very dark, cool. The road's mostly empty. And they carry their spices, little alabaster jars. And you can hear them clinking, the pottery in their bags as they walk along. But then as they approach the tomb, they remember, who will move the stone for us? They can't do it. But still, they keep walking. We don't know why. Maybe they hoped to find someone who would be able to help them. Maybe they thought the guards might be persuaded. Maybe they just couldn't stay away. They passed the hill where the crucifixions took place on the main road. The uprights of the three crosses would still be standing at the entrance to the quarry. But just beyond them, not far at all, in a small garden, carved into the rock is the tomb that they left a few days back. But something's wrong. They'd been wondering how they'd move the stone. But when they see that it's already been rolled away, they don't feel relief. It brings dread. Because there's no way this is able to be good news. It couldn't have been one of Jesus' other disciples. The women were there as early as was possible for them to arrive. And that meant that it was either Romans or robbers who got there first. And so they run to the tomb. It's still dark. But even in the half light, they can see the tomb is completely empty. Mary doesn't wait for the others. She turns and she runs straight back to the safe house they're staying in. She finds Peter, she finds John, she blurts out, "They have taken the Lord, and we don't know where they've put him." You can hear the panic in her voice. But now it's Peter and John's turn to run. Probably not a smart move if you're trying to avoid attention in a city where Roman soldiers are watching out for revolutionaries, but they run anyway. John arrives first and he stops at the entrance. He stoops down to peer in. The first light of dawn just creeping over the quarry. Inside, he can just make out the linen burial cloth, carefully folded. He hesitates. Maybe thinking about the Romans, perhaps this is some kind of trap. But then Peter arrives, and as usual, Peter doesn't stop and just barrels straight into the tomb, and then John follows him. Inside, they find the burial cloths neatly arranged, the linen strips still there, the face cloth folded, set aside. No chaos. No panic, no sign of a robbery. And this moment, something clicks for John. He looks at the linen and he starts to realize that this wasn't a body stolen in the night. This wasn't the work of thieves or soldiers. Because you see, robbers or Romans would never have removed the shroud. The body would have been covered in a mixture, as we said, myrrh and aloes, which forms a thick, sticky, resin-like glue. And if anyone had tried to remove the body, the linen would have been torn and ripped to shreds and spread all over the tomb. It would have been messy, but everything here is calm. It's as if the body had simply passed through the shroud rather than peeled off it. And John looks, and in this moment, he believes. But he adds this lovely detail. "We believed, but we still did not understand from Scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead." And I love that moment. John saying, "I believed," but then followed by, "I don't know really what I believed yet." I wonder if any of us relate to that. I believe, I'm not really sure what I believe. And that's fine, because one of the things we see in this story is that sometimes faith comes piece by piece rather than all at once. Mary's already on her way back to the tomb, and it doesn't seem like she passes Peter and John. Or if she does, she's too lost in grief to really take a moment to recognize them. She returns alone. Mary's still weeping. She believes the body's been taken, so she's still searching. She's on the hunt. And like John before her, Mary now bends down to really look into the tomb. But now the linen cloths are gone as well. And in their place are two angels seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head, one at the foot. And they simply ask, "Woman, why are you crying?" And to us, it sounds like a strange question. It sounds rude. But with God, tears aren't ever wasted. Loads of times in the Bible, Hagar, Hannah, David, Jesus himself, only a few days before, God always hears and responds to the sound of the weeping. So tears really, I think, are a kind of prayer in their own right. But Mary answers the angels very simply. "They've taken my Lord away, and I do not know where they have put him." And then she turns and she sees a man standing in the garden. She assumes that he's the gardener. And in a way, he is. Because this isn't the first time a woman stood in a garden, disoriented by loss. It's not the first time God came looking for someone that he loved. And John wants us to think of that other time. I'm not adding this as a layer. This is what John wants from us to see. He wants us to remember right to the beginning. Last week, John took us back to creation. And in his opening words, he said, "In the beginning." Now in chapter 20, he's doing the same thing again. He's taking us back to that garden. And we think of Eve. She and Adam have just eaten the fruit. And in that moment, they feel the weight of everything they've just lost. The perfect relationship that they had with God and the wholeness that they felt from being his image bearers. They reflected his love, his life, his light into creation. And that's what we were made for. But when they reached for the fruit, they lost all that. And at its root, the power of sin comes from our worship. We give our hearts to things that are not God. And none of those things are evil in themselves. There's nothing wrong with them. But worship's about what we give our very highest priority to. And when we give it to anything less than God, even really good things, they become powers that start to warp us out of shape. And in this case, Adam and Eve chose to make themselves God. To Eve, Adam, they're in that garden. They're trying to make sense of what's happened. They feel a sense of nakedness, and it goes way beyond the physical. They've lost their sense, we put it last week, the sense of vocation. And then somewhere in the distance, they hear a voice. It's a voice they know so well, the voice that they loved more than any other. But it sounded different today. "Where are you?" The voice was the gardener's, God's voice. It's the same voice they'd walk with every day in the garden. But his usual call, "Adam, Eve, where are you?" had turned into a heartbroken cry of, "Where are you?" They were hiding from God for the first time. And we've been hiding ever since. You can't be a mirror of God's light if you're hiding in the dark. And we still hide, little fig leaves, cover our shame. We've all got secret selves. The different ways we struggle, the different ways that the powers we spoke about last week are able to twist and grip us. And it's the saddest story, isn't it? Paradise lost. Because ever since, our hearts have been completely restless because we were made for God. And when we hide from him, we ache to be found by him. And so we set about putting other things up in God's place, hoping to find that sense of completeness that comes from reflecting the love and life of God back into the world. But it only ever makes things worse. And so there's Eve in the garden, God calling for her, but she's hiding in the bushes. Already, she knows how these powers get their hooks in you and start to warp you out of shape. And she knows already that it all ends in death. Hiding from God leads, we all know this so well, don't we, to a disordered world, to a distorted heart, and to that lost calling. But back to the other garden, Mary's still crying. And she as well is so deeply aware of where it all leads. She's witnessed the absolute worst consequences of sin over the past few days, and it led to death again. a question, why does it always lead to death? Why does the chain never break? The man that she loved more than any other, wrongly accused, beaten, humiliated, crucified. She watched him as he breathed his last. And then there's that long, silent Sabbath day of helpless grief. And now even his body has gone. She's broken. She's racked with sobs, terrified, confused, alone. And all she wants is to find his body, to do one last thing for him, who did everything for her, to make sure that he's now at peace. Just like Eve, Mary stands lost in a garden. But this time things are going differently. She hears a voice. And it's a voice she loves more than any other. It's the voice of the gardener. Mariam. Mariam, he says. It's one word. That word's her name. And everything from then on changes in that one moment because she knows the voice. She knows the name. She knows the man. She saw him die. She knows he died. But now he's alive. She doesn't understand it at all, but she believes. She calls out, Rabboni, my teacher. And she doesn't think twice. She clings to him. And so we see where Eve fled, Mary searched. And where Eve hid, Mary clings. Where are you? Turns to being called by name, Mariam. We often speak in very complex theological terms about what happened on the cross, as we should. It's very important. And those explanations matter. But sometimes, and I think this time, a single frame of a story says more than a whole complicated system of thought could ever manage. And because both scenes we've looked at today are of all of us, we're all there, hiding in the garden. We're all there as Jesus calls us by name. And so there are two garden stories in the Bible. And we get to choose which one will be ours. We get to choose. The first is the story where we hide, where God comes walking, calling out, where are you? And we keep ourselves hidden in shame, fear, pride. But then there's the second story, where we turn, where we cling, because we have seen the one who came to find us, and the one who went through death and who came out on the other side. And as strong as death is love. And love calls us all by name. Love calls you by name. And so you can have all the theological explanations you want, and they're good. But this moment of Mary turning, Mary hearing her name, of Mary clinging to Jesus. This tells me more about what the cross means, what the cross did for me, for you, than any book that I've ever read. And so for 2 weeks, we've told the story of what happened at Golgotha. And we've told it very purposefully as a story, because that's how John told it. But like lots of good stories, it ends with a question. And the question's, which garden will be yours? Which garden will be yours.